But before we get into it, I want to talk to you about when I used to work at the Air Force Base. Now, I did 3 summer internships at the Air Force Base. And if you've ever worked out there, you know that they take safety incredibly serious. Okay? Incredibly serious. Even though I was never going to get close to anything technical at all, we had to do training over all of the safety precautions that we need to take of anywhere we might find ourselves being in. And one of those, I recall, is confined spaces. Right? Lance is laughing because over and over and over again, it's like warning. Now, I was outdoors. Okay, I was not going to be anywhere close to any such thing as a confined space. The closest confined space I would be in was a cubicle. And that was walking in to check in and walking right back out. But because I worked there, I had to go through this training. And the dangers of it is sometimes people enter these confined spaces maybe to repair something, maybe because they seem like at the time that this is a good idea, right? But if they don't have the proper precautions, if they don't know how to go into this, it can be really, really dangerous, if not deadly. And we're talking about in our journey, we're talking about this whole sacred journey that God has called us on. And I think about it, and we get to Exodus, and the one word that comes to mind is captivity. We left last week with Joseph being fruitful, right, and forgiving his brothers and going on this incredible journey himself of loss and triumph and reconciliation. And prior to that, we talked about Abram, who, upon the call of a God that his family didn't even know, leaves, right? God says, go. Didn't tell him where, didn't tell him how, just called him to go. And he did. And that call is a call that we each have in our lives, both as the family here at Highland Hills, as well as individuals. We all are called to a purpose in accordance to God's greater plan and story. And so Abram gave us a great example of that. But now we encounter in the narrative that Israel is not in the state that they had once, that they once were. They're now in captivity. In captivity, confinement can be a very, very devastating place to be. Because for far too often, we come into it unwittingly. And before long, we look back and we find ourselves shackled in a way that we never anticipated, never desired, right? Whether we're shackled to our addiction, whether we're shackled to regrets, whether we're shackled to our past, whether we're shackled to our fears, we find ourselves captive in a land that is hostile to freedom. This happens both individually and as a society. And what happens is, it's hard to have the imagination to see anything beyond being captive. And so we get trapped. And we get stuck. And we have intentions, and we have motivations, and we make vows, and we try to get out of this captivity. But the system continues to just pour down more and more and more shackles. And that's what we see here when we get in the book of Exodus. Israel is in Egypt, and Moses has an incredible story, and we'll actually talk more about Moses' story when we get to Jesus, at least the birth story. But Moses rises up, you know, he is saved out of the river, he becomes prominent within Egyptian society, but he sees his Hebrew brothers being mistreated. And what does he do? Well, he takes matters into his own hands, right? You know, interesting thing about vengeance is saying to God that I know better how to handle the situation than you do. Because all throughout the Bible, we're told, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord, right? But in this particular instance, Moses takes matters into his own hands. He kills the Egyptian that was persecuting or abusing his Hebrew brothers. And then he's caught, right? He's found out by his own Hebrew brothers who saw his act and say, are you going to do this to us again? And what does he do? He runs. That seems like the most, I mean, we were built anatomically to run, right? But in a spiritual sense, that always seems to be the easiest option, doesn't it? When we encounter some sort of struggle, when we encounter some sort of captivity, it always seems easier to run. And that's what he does. He flees to the land of Midian. And he stays there for a really long time. And so looking at the end of chapter 2, this all is in Exodus chapter 2, says verse 23, "During those many days the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew." Some translations say there, God knew it was time to act. There are two different kinds of captivity that's happening here. Yes, Moses has fled Egypt. He is no longer there, and he is not a slave. But he's captive to his past. The past that he left in Egypt for decades. The people of Israel, however, they are captive in a very physical, real sense, right? They cannot see anything above day in and day out slavery and captivity, of struggle, of oppression. This is the reality for them. And it's interesting that there's these two different circumstances that God collides together into one call. And we see that call in chapter 3. "Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Oreb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, 'I'll turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned.' When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, 'Moses, Moses.' And he said, 'Here I am.'" It's one of those times. I wish I had that James Earl Jones voice right there. You know, Moses. You know, that's the image we always have in our mind. And he calls out to him and he says, "Do not come near." Verse 5. "Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." And he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. So here we have God encountering Moses here in the wilderness, on the mountain. And you have to ask, and I've heard someone else ask this before, you know, generally shepherds don't tend their flock or lead their flock in places where they are not familiar with, right? I wonder how many times did Moses go along the same path and completely miss the fact that this is holy ground? I mean, it hadn't just become holy, right? And it makes me also think, and others that I've read, they kind of think the same thing, is how many burning bushes do we walk by day in, day out, God's presence on our left and on our right, that we completely miss because we cannot get beyond our captivity of that moment or what we're fleeing from, what we're running from. And we completely miss the fact that God is right here all around us all the time, that the place where we're standing and walking is holy ground, and that he may be calling us to take off our sandals because he has something sacred he wants to call us to. And so when we see here, God calls to him and he gives him his identity. God says, "This is who I am." And then he proceeds to tell him that he has seen the suffering. He's seen the anguish. He's seen the pain of his people in Egypt. And he's decided to act. And guess how he's acting? Well, he's going to send Moses. God always is looking for a body to represent him here on earth. A body that can be touched and tangible and seen and felt, but is a reflection of that which is transient, transcendent. Something, a reflection of his glory. You know, we talk about like we're to be his hands and feet, right? This is the way we generally say this. But he's always looking for a body here to represent him, to accomplish his glory. And of course, Moses, as many of us do when God knocks on our door and invites us into this journey, what does he do? Sure, God, I'll go with you. Right? That's what Abram did. Joseph, we don't know. I mean, Joseph's story was a little less certain about that because he kind of got thrust into it unwillingly, but he turned it out for good. And he never questioned God. I think if I did some real personal reflection, I'm most like Moses in that this sense. When I perceive that God is calling to something great, instead of wholesale embracing this, my gut reaction is to say, well, God, you know, I'm not really qualified for this. I don't really speak well. I don't really know enough. I don't really have the ability to do this. I don't foresee how I factor into this plan, right? I mean, Moses is going through all of the reasons that are very valid. And from a standpoint of logic, you know, Moses is probably sitting there thinking, well, there are far more people that are far more qualified than I am to do this. And what's really interesting here, we'll begin reading verse 7, where we left off. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? So here is one. I mean, Moses has many more objections in the next chapter. But here again, who am I that I should be the one to do this? And how does God reply? Does he give him a list of the reasons why he has chosen? Or does he say, well, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I'll pick someone else. He doesn't do that, does he? What does he respond with? He says, but I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. All right, so you're sitting there, you're doing your chores, you're working your farm, and all of a sudden you see a sight that you couldn't believe. And you go upon it, and God says, I want you to go into the most powerful nation on earth, and I want you to rescue every one of my people out of it. I mean, it's no wonder that Moses is sitting here saying, I'm not really your guy. But what's really interesting is that Moses, that's the exact same thing that Moses tried to do under his own power, his own strength, decades before, and was not successful. And in fact, he left Egypt in regret. I mean, you think about those places of captivity for you. How difficult is it to go and revisit that place? Whatever that Egypt is for you. You're trying to run away from it, and God's telling you, no, I want you to go back into it. I want you to redeem it, to rescue from it. That's hard. That's the last thing we want to do, right? The last thing we want to do is run back into the place of our regret. But that's exactly where God is calling Moses to go. Go back to the very place that you spent your whole life running from. Because I have a purpose for you in it. And so after Moses gives all these objections and God gives him signs to show, he agrees, right? Reluctantly, but he does. And so what is the plight of the Israelites when he gets there? Well, he goes, and we're looking in chapter 5. Afterward, Moses and Aaron, he gives Aaron to go with him, to kind of be a spokesman for him, went and said to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. So here you are, you have a pharaoh of the greatest superpower in the world at that time, who his entire infrastructure is built on the backs of these slaves. And then he's got these two guys who are gracing his court by inviting him to say, let all my people go out and worship God on this mountain. For Pharaoh, he's sitting there saying, I don't know who this God is. No, I'm not going to do that. In fact, not only am I not going to do that, I'm going to place heavier burdens on the people so that they will not be inclined to do this any further. Right? And I think in our land of captivity, in our time of captivity, both as individuals and as a society, this is what we feel like the experience of our day-to-day life is. We live in an anxiety-driven system in which you have a pyramid in which those at the top try to define reality for the rest, right, according to their purposes. And you have God who says, no, I don't want you to live in an anxiety-driven system in which your value is based on the number of bricks you produce day in and day out. I want you to live in a system that's defined by Sabbath, that's defined by freedom, that's defined by true liberty, not from a legal standpoint, but from a spiritual one. This is what God is inviting this community to. How hard is it to imagine life beyond your captivity? It's difficult, isn't it? Especially if you've been there for a long time. Whether we're talking about as individuals or as a society, it's difficult to imagine something different. I've often, in some of the literature I've read on church growth, they kind of use the picture of a dance. When you are dancing together, like everybody in this room, we're dancing together, all you can see is the person beside you, right? But if you go up on a balcony and you look at it, you kind of get a bigger picture, a different conception of what is actually going on. And that's what God is inviting Moses and the community to see. To see something greater than this system of Pharaoh and making bricks and oppression. But to see something greater of freedom and liberation and presence. And that's what he's inviting them out to. I remember, how many of you have ever seen those shows? Now, I don't get really TV now, but I used to watch shows like The World's Dumbest Criminals. You ever seen those shows? Right? I remember distinctly one time these two criminals had like somehow got out of the gate. Like they closed the gate behind them and left them outside. Now, like for most of us, we'll say, like, run, right? I mean, you're free. And they turn back around and they start beating on the door like, let me back in, let me back in. Now, obviously, they did the right thing. They should have done that. But I think that is a picture of what happens to many of us when we are offered the gift of liberation from our captivity. Instead of turning and joining God on a journey, we turn back around and we beat back on the door. Why? Because that can sometimes feel like a place of comfort. It's difficult and it's oppressive, but it's what we know. Or, as Dave Ramsey likes to say, it's like a child with a dirty diaper. It's dirty, nasty, and stinky, but it's all mine, right? And I want to sit in it. And, you know, sometimes that's just the way that we operate in our nature. But here, and we even see this in the people of Israel. All right, so we know that there were 10 plagues that were sent, and the people were finally on the brink of freedom. And I want to turn to chapter 14. We're skipping quite a bit. And so now we have the people who have been set free. I mean, they're running, right? They're going across the Red Sea, and they're there. And Pharaoh changes his mind. He had a change of heart whenever his firstborn died, that 10th plague. And he said, go, I'm done with them. But then he changed his mind and said, no, actually, I want them back. And so he's chasing them. And in verse 10, when Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them. and they feared greatly. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." I mean, this is oftentimes the mentality. I have been offered the gift of freedom, and it's right there. And right, oftentimes, right when we're on the brink of change and liberation and exodus, that's oftentimes when we give up. Right when we're at the brink, right when we're at the edge, we oftentimes give up. And they have been crying out for years and years, "God, deliver us, free us. We want this change." And then when God brings this change, they grow nostalgic about Egypt. I mean, they grow nostalgic about their time in captivity. Well, we really don't. Just let's go back and serve them. We'll just blow this whole thing off. We'll say we're sorry. We'll do whatever Pharaoh says as long as we leave with our life. But if you recall 2 weeks ago, there was a quote from Gary Haugen that kind of pertains to this. He says, God calls us beyond what we're comfortable with. God calls us beyond what's convenient. God calls us into the risk. And that's a really, really, really scary word in our culture, isn't it? We know what it's like in Egypt. At least we know what's going on. It's terrible, but we know what's going to happen. We don't know when we cross the Red Sea what that looks like. We can't see the bigger picture. We can't get above the dance floor. We can't conceptualize what a different social order looks like. An order not built on the backs of slaves, but built on the gift of God's love. We don't know what that looks like. And so instead of wanting to run into that, they just want to run back. Beat back on the door. Say, "Let me back in." Because it's comfortable. It's convenient. You know, risk is something to be avoided in our culture. Risk is something that we assess, right? It's something that we manage. It's something that we regulate. It's something that we define. But that's exactly what it takes to follow God's call on the sacred journey, is to embrace the risk of change. Because it's in the risk of change that our exodus happens. It's in our embracing His call beyond what we can see and what we're comfortable with, that we find our true liberation. And so here, Moses, he starts crying out to God. I mean, verse 13 says, "Moses said to the people, 'Fear not, stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which He will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent.'" So Moses has this incredible faith in this moment. But then he starts crying out to the Lord. And the Lord says to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward. Lift up your staff, stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen." Then the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. Verse 21, "Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And in the morning watch, the Lord and the pillar of fire and of cloud looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into a panic, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, 'Let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians.'" Wherever you're at in your journey this morning, whatever thing it is that is taking your heart captive, whether it's an addiction that is secret and you've never told another soul, whether it's a past that you are all too ready to run away from, whether it's a regret that happened just yesterday, wherever it is that you have been shackled to, whatever your captivity, your Egypt is, embrace the risk of transformation. Embrace the risk of Exodus. Exodus is a Greek term, literally means to journey out. Journey out of it. Embrace God. Have the courage to see and imagine life not built on anxiety over your Egypt, but built on the freedom of God's order, of Sabbath, of presence, of His truth. And trust that whatever that battle is in your life, and this is important, this is as much for me as it is for everyone else. I heard a preacher say one time, I'm preaching to myself and you all are just overhearing it. And I oftentimes feel that way of allowing God to take up the battle. Trust Him for that. To not take the easy road of running back into Egypt, but embracing what the wilderness holds. This morning, if you need to take up that call, if you need to embrace God's call, or if you've never even come to faith in Christ and you say, I know Christ is the way, the truth, and the life, and He's calling me into a life not of captivity to the power struggles and the systems of this world, but He's calling me into His gracious love and peace through salvation in Him. If you need that this morning and you want to make that profession and come and be immersed into Him, or if you just need prayers for strength and for rescue out of captivity, you can come forward or pull us aside afterwards as we stand and sing.